or regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me today. We've got a busy show for you. We're going to be talking with Mark Oliva from the National Shooting Sports Foundation here in just a moment or two about the, about a variety of topics, including, though, the fact that many gun sales have been on hold in the state of Nevada for more than 2 weeks now. There was a cyber attack that apparently hit a lot of state agencies, including the Nevada Department of Public Safety, which is the point of contact for NICS in the state of Nevada. So if you have to go through a background check to purchase a firearm, which is basically everybody but concealed carry holders in the state of Nevada, you've been in limbo for more than 2 weeks now. I spoke with a gun store owner in Nevada yesterday who said, yeah, you know, this is having a real impact on her business. Customers are either, you know, she's got more than 20 firearms that are just, she can't deliver to the customers who've purchased them. But then you've also got people who are saying, well, I'm not going to buy a gun now. Why would I do that? Why would I spend money when I don't know when I'm going to be able to get it? So this is having a real impact on gun sellers and would-be gun owners as well. So we'll talk about that in just a second. We also know that the Third Circuit released its opinion in Coons and Siegel versus Platkin. That's the challenge to the post-Bruin carry laws adopted by New Jersey. I have not had a chance to read the 235-page decision in its entirety. I've kind of skimmed over it. The big takeaway, the court did find that the state's ban on concealed carry in private vehicles, the so-called vampire rule that banned concealed carry by default on all private property, that those are likely unconstitutional, found that the $50 fee that applicants have to pay to this, you know, violence prevention fund is also likely unconstitutional, found that the state's liability insurance requirement for concealed carry holders also likely unconstitutional. But the panel did uphold basically every other gun-free zone that was challenged in these lawsuits, including, you know, libraries, public assemblies, actually with carrying within 100 feet of a public assembly that where a permit is required, beaches, parks, zoos, all kinds of places. And they used different reasoning, right? In some cases, they found that there were historical analogies that were applicable. Some cases, they found that the questions were moot. Some cases, they found that the plaintiffs did not have standing to challenge those particular gun-free zones. There was a pretty lengthy dissent. So this was a 2-1 decision. I've not read through the entirety of the dissent as well, but the dissenting judge essentially would have struck down every one of the gun-free zones, at least the ones that I've seen so far. I've not found a single one that he would have upheld. So what happens next? It's an open question. Because this was sort of a split decision, Attorney General Matt Platkin could appeal directly to the Supreme Court. He could ask for an en banc review. The plaintiffs could ask for an en banc review or take their appeal directly to the Supreme Court. I suspect that given the good decisions that we've seen from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals en banc, including Range versus Garland, I would not be surprised if actually both the plaintiffs and the defendants actually ask for that en banc appeal, albeit for different reasons. Platkin wants to keep this issue away from the Supreme Court for as long as possible. And, you know, the plaintiffs might believe that they can get a better verdict, frankly, from a larger panel of Third Circuit judges. So we will wait and see. But we do have coverage for you on the Third Circuit's decision there at thebearingarms.com. All right. Let's turn our attention now to our conversation with Mark Oliva from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Again, talk about what's going on in Nevada, as well as some good news out of Florida. But we'll start with the Silver State's gun problem, where these gun sales are stuck in limbo. Take a look and a listen. Mark, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to talk to you, sir.
Cam, it's always a pleasure to see you. I appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely. You know, and I'm curious. I know that there might not be anything that NSSF can do here, but you all are aware of what's going on in Nevada, what's been going on, I guess, for more than 2 weeks now, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty tough situation. And we've been working with the governor's office to try and get some answers and get this fixed. But unfortunately, because the systems were hacked at the state of Nevada and some ransomware, it's affected all the statewide systems, not just, you know, the ability for firearm retailers to run background checks in the state of Nevada. It's also, you know, everything through the DMV. So the, you know, officials there have had to go through the systems and isolate them and try and fix this problem and bring the systems back up. The hopeful news on this is that we think that they're probably going to have the situation for background checks fixed within the next day or so, is what the governor's office is telling NSSF. But to kind of give you a little bit of background, and I'm going to rely on notes here because this is a bit of a TikTok to go back.
Sure.
So this all goes back to 2016. And that's when Nevada's voters passed by referendum a ballot initiative for universal background checks.
Right.
And it's going to require all background checks, whether that be a retail sale or a private sale, to be run through the FBI NICS system. Well, FBI came back and said, we are not going to run any background checks for a private sale. That's not what the FBI NICS is set up for. It's for retail sales.
Mm-hmm.
So that law sat dead for a couple of years. It was unenforceable law. So the voters approved that in 2016. The FBI refused that. They said they couldn't do it. In 2017 through 2018, the law kind of sat dead. And then in 2019, they went back and rewrote the law so they could run background checks through the Nevada's Department of Public Safety. So that's kind of where the situation is now, is that all background checks run through Nevada's Department of Public Safety, kind of like a middleman. So I think the analogy that was used with me, and I'll use it with you, was if you think back to the show The Office, is the customer comes to the salesman goes to the boss goes back to the salesman and back to the customer. That's essentially what's happening with background checks through a point of contact system that they have in Nevada. When all their systems became attacked by this ransomware attack that's affecting everything in Nevada, it also affected their ability to run background checks. The law in Nevada does not allow them to go use the FBI system to run those background checks because, again, the FBI won't run it on a background check for a private sale. And Nevada's law requires all universal background checks, so they have to be run through the point of contact check system. All that said, to tell you, Camp, this is exactly why NSSF is always telling these states that want to become partial point of contact states or point of contact states, not a good idea. One, you're wasting your state dollars. You know, you've got the system that's already in place. Mm-hmm. And that two is that we've shown that the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check system is much more reliable and is less vulnerable to these kinds of attacks than we're seeing what's happening in Nevada.
Absolutely.
It's been tough. We know it for the retailers. We're hearing from them. And we've sent out alerts, letting them know what's happening. This is something we can't fix on our side. We can only push the governor's office to do more. And the Governor Lombardo's staff is on top of this. They're working on it. They're trying to bring those up. I think they've already got like a DMV site back up. But they're within the next day or two that they're going to bring the background check system back up. So there's light at the end of the tunnel, but it's not quite here yet.
Okay, well, that is some good news, because I was talking to a gun store owner yesterday, and of course, you know, the rumor mill is flying, right? So she had heard it could be 2 months before this system was back up and running, and I asked her, I was like, well, where did you hear that from? And she said, well, it was one of my employees, I'm talking to her on the phone, it's very busy, obviously, and she's like, do you know where you got that information from? No, don't worry, I got that information from. So she will be relieved to hear that. But as you say, this is a problem, right? And so it's not as easy as simply going to the FBI and saying, listen, our system's down. Can we use the NICS system, right? The state law doesn't allow that. I guess one fix, as you say, would be to drop this point of contact nonsense, but you'd also have to get rid of universal background checks if you do that, right?
And that's it. And these initiatives, that particularly Nevada, was done by voter referendum. But when states are pushing in these universal background check laws, sometimes there's not consideration of what the second and third order effects of those could be.
Yeah.
Of course, we don't have a national universal background check. In order for that to happen, you would have to have a national firearm registry. You and I as gun owners would have to be on a government watch list, and that's illegal. You cannot do that at the federal level. But there's nothing barring the states from having universal background check requirements, and they're running these, but they're not thinking about some of these second and third order effects that are happening right now to Nevada.
Well,
retailers are in a lurch.
Absolutely. And this is, I hate to say it, but I think this is going to become more common. We've seen these cyber attacks, major cyber attacks that have taken place for the last few years, right? And you've had private entities, hospitals get hit with the ransomware. But increasingly, we are starting to see state agencies become victim to these attacks. And, again, when you're dead in the water as an FFL, what are your recourses here, right? I mean, you can try to sue, but even if you get injunctive relief, I mean, that's going to take weeks, right? Maybe the system comes back up by then. This is a really difficult situation for these FFLs and for their customers, Because I don't know that there is a good answer as to how to fix this problem when they're dead in the water. They can't actually give people the guns that they've purchased.
Yeah, it becomes really tough. I mean, in Nevada situation, you're essentially sitting on a 2-week waiting period. I mean, you can have them fill out the 4473, but you can't run that background check. They're holding all that stuff and they're sitting on that inventory that's just piling up day after day after day. That's unfair to the customer. That's unfair to the retailer. And essentially, at the end of the day, you're looking at this is depriving somebody of their Second Amendment rights. If someone needs to be able to protect themselves and their family, and they're not able to legally purchase a firearm, this becomes a Second Amendment issue. So we need to make sure that this gets resolved. We're confident that Governor Lombardo is on top of this. We're confident that he's not someone who's sitting on going, well, we'll get to it when we need to. We know where he stands on the Second Amendment. We know how important the industry is to him, especially there in Nevada, especially having us there with SHOT Show in Las Vegas.
Right.
He's been to our governor's forums. He's very supportive of the industry. And we're thankful for that kind of relationship. And this is obviously something that he didn't do. This is something that was attacked on the state system. So, you know, we're very confident. We're very hopeful that we'll be able to have a resolution to this quickly. But we know that the effect that's happening on the retailers out there, and it's very difficult for them right now.
I hope that this will, you know, prompt some lawmakers in Nevada to, you know, again, I doubt you're going to see a repeal of the universal background check requirement. But maybe legislation could be offered that, you know, listen, in the case, if the system goes down again, that we revert back to, you know, background checks on commercial sales only, and we use the NICS system instead of this point of contact nonsense, because there has to, as you say, people's rights are being denied here. So there needs to be, I think, some sort of system in place. We know now that this can happen, right? And so now the question is, okay, so when this happens again, what do we do to ensure that people's Second Amendment rights are not implicated? That to me is, I guess, the challenge for lawmakers right now.
Yeah, and there's things they need to be thinking about. And if you think about even the federal background check that you and I endure, we go buy a gun. You know, the FBI has you know, a limited amount of time where they can come back and delay you to get a better answer. And if mm-hmm. they don't have that delay, the retailer can proceed with that transaction while the FBI continues to investigate that. Personally, I've never had to wait probably more than 3 minutes for my background check to come back. But, you know, for some others, you know, it can sometimes be in a delay process. And you know, having this a perpetual delay becomes a denial of rights. And that's why the FBI has a limited window on how long they can hold that before someone's allowed to transfer that firearm. And again, that's up to the retailer if they want to do that. In many cases, a firearm retailer will not transfer that firearm if they don't have a positive proceed with that transaction. But this is where it shows that this becomes a difficulty. If the systems aren't in place to be able to ensure that we're only transferring firearms to those who are not a prohibited person, and those systems aren't telling us the answers, well, like you said, we're essentially denying somebody their Second Amendment rights because of an administrative error.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the gun store owner I talked to yesterday said she had 20 guns, more than 20 guns, that were just sitting there. People had paid for them. She couldn't give them their guns because she's not able to conduct these background checks. And again, you know, in Nevada, if you've got a concealed carry license, that basically suffices as your background check. So, you know, CHL holders are not impacted by this. But first-time gun owners are. Right. That individual who finds themselves in a position where I need to get a gun. I don't feel safe right now. I've got a stalker. I've got an abuser. I want to be able to protect myself. They're stuck. They have no good options. The only way for them to get a gun is to break the law.
Yeah. And we certainly don't encourage anyone to break right. the law. No. Need to get this fixed. Need to get it right.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. Well, let's talk about some better news, Mark. You've got down in Florida, a Second Amendment tax holiday, which is, you know, we've got some states that do this for a weekend, maybe a week. Florida, they're doing it basically the last 3 months of the year, right? September 9th, or I guess it started on Monday, on December 31st, tax-free firearms, ammunition, hunting supplies, right?
Through the end of the year. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that Governor DeSantis proposed in his budget this year going forward. And he thought about doing a Second Amendment summer from Memorial Day through September. And as it came out through the legislative process, it actually benefited Florida taxpayers even more and Florida customers even more, because now you have a bigger window. It's running from September through the end of December, where you're not going to be charged taxes for a purchase of a gun, ammunition, hunting supplies, tree stands, scopes, optics, anything else, the stuff that's associated with suppressors, all that stuff. The sales tax in Florida is going to be waived for those for the next few months. What a great way to encourage people to invest in their own safety, invest in their Second Amendment rights, and ensure that they have the freedom to exercise those rights. I know there's a lot of people have, you know, concerns about, you know, taxing people's rights, and that's a legitimate argument that can be had. Mm-hmm. But here you have Governor DeSantis has stepped up in a really big way to lead this effort in his state to make sure that the people that he is in charge of ensuring that they're able to exercise their rights can do so with the least amount of limitations. Now, let's put that all into contrast with what we see in Colorado and in California. Colorado and California impose an excise tax on the sale of every firearm. So California, you're paying an extra 11% to the state, which is going to fund their gun control programs,
right,
in order to exercise your Second Amendment right. Colorado passed this past year, it's enacted now, a 6.5% excise tax on the sale of firearms and ammunition in that state. So you've got states that are trying to suppress your ability to exercise your Second Amendment right. And then you've got Florida. And Florida is leading the charge to make sure that they, people in their state can exercise their Second Amendment rights unencumbered. And yeah. I think it's fabulous. I think it's great. I think the figures that we've seen are into the tens of millions of dollars. It will be able to save, you know, Florida taxpayers, Florida customers who are going to buy it. I've got a very good friend in Florida who I served with in the Marine Corps back in the day, back when I was a much younger guy with no gray hair. But, you know, he told me the other day he is absolutely in the market. He's going to take advantage of this ability to buy a gun tax-free on that sales tax during this window. He is hot to trot to put another gun in the safe. And I'll go on. Have fun with it. I mean, this is something that's incredible. I would be ecstatic if other states started copying what's happening in Florida to make this happen for their states as well.
Absolutely. And again, it does go back, I think, to the idea that, you know, should we really be taxing the exercise of a constitutional right? I know this is a general tax, right? This is not a specific levy, unlike California and Colorado, right? That excise tax is specifically an extra tax on a constitutional right. This is a general sales tax. But to exempt Second Amendment related products, I think, again, as you say, it's a fabulous thing. I love the fact that we're seeing this go from, you know, a sales tax weekend, sales tax free week, to now, you know, a sales tax free quarter. Maybe one day Florida will lead the way and we'll have a year round tax free holiday on our right to keep bear arms. But this is a huge step in the right direction. I hope that it does spur other states to do the same. And one other thing I wanted to talk with you about, we'll go back to the bad news, I guess. We'll donut in the good news here. This is something that we've been talking about for years, Mark, the trouble that members of the firearms industry have with financial institutions, right? And whether it's, you know, going back to Operation Choke Point, where the Obama administration basically said, you know, the firearms industry is a disfavored industry, and banks, if you're doing business with them, you're opening yourself up to all kinds of additional scrutiny, right? We're going to go in and look at your books because you're doing business with Bob, the gun store owner. Supposedly, this is being dealt with, right? I mean, Operation Choke Point is coming to an end. We've seen President Trump's executive order calling for an end to discrimination in banking, but we're still seeing some discrimination in banking, it sounds like.
Yeah. So we were reached out to by one of our members, a very big company, Silencer Central. Brandon Maddox, the CEO there, let us know that he had been reached out to by JP Morgan Wealth Management and saying that they wanted to be able to do business with him and Silencer Central. Brandon was very generous to be able to share his emails, the email chain with us. He reached back and said, great, I'd love to learn more. Do you do business with members of the fire ministry? And the answer that he got back was, unfortunately, we do not. Now, again, President Trump's executive order to stop this debanking has a 180-day window. That 180-day window is only about 30 or so days into it. So you got a little bit more time for these banks to come online. But the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates the banks, has been very forceful on this to say that they are not going to tolerate this. They have removed all debanking language from their lexicon. It's out of all of their manuals and all the regulations. They're issuing new guidance just this past week to tell the banks that they need to start stepping in line with the executive order, and they're going to start to enforce this. Well, this note from JP Morgan Wealth Management seemed to indicate that, if anything, JP Morgan might be slow walking their compliance with this. But I've got an update for you.
Okay.
Just this morning,
yeah,
we got a note back from Brandon Maddox again that he was reached out to by others at higher up the chain at JP Morgan Wealth Management. And they told him, we're sorry, we made a mistake. We absolutely will do business with members of the fire ministry. So it appears that JP Morgan is trying to come back online with what the president put outlined in the executive order. So while we're very concerned that that was not going to be happening, the indication seems to be that at least at the very senior levels that they're saying, yep, we cannot do this. We're trying to change course. We saw earlier this year that Citibank said that they would start doing business with the industry again. Mm-hmm. And again, we're taking a Ronald Reagan approach on this. We trust, but we verify. So we'll take you at your word, but we want to see proof in your words. We want to see you take action. So if we start to see JP Morgan Chase, the whole family of JP Morgan banking start to do business, which they have not done business. JP Diamond testified on Capitol Hill saying that they would not do business with anybody who made modern sporting rifles or AR-15 style rifles or standard capacity magazines. If they start to change and start to bank people who make a constitutional product that's legal to sell, legal to own, then we won't have an issue. But I think the president has been very clear on this. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency has been very clear on this. The Senate Banking Committee, Chairman Tim Scott out of South Carolina, has been absolutely clear on this. I think that if they don't see that compliance, you will start to see some of these CEOs being dragged up in front of Congress and start answering questions as to why they're not in compliance. But this is a very good indication that we saw just this morning that JP Morgan Wealth Management has come back to Silencer Central, back to Brandon Maddox, and said, we're sorry, we made a mistake, we will do business with you, we welcome your business. So we want to be able to see more of that in the right direction. We're not looking for any special favors for those in the industry. If someone is not, you know, meeting that objective criteria to be worth doing business with, then that's a different story.
Right.
But if someone is being debanked or being discriminated against simply because there are corporate executives who don't like the product that they make, that is discrimination. That's running afoul of the executive order. So we're thankful to the president for doing this. We're thankful for the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency for the push in the Senate. And you know, we're thankful that we've seen that the executives are starting to come back in line. But we, again, want to see the proof of that in the coming days and weeks.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, I'm glad we got into the conversation on a high note after all, Mark. Yeah. That is good news to hear. Well, listen, thank you again for coming on the program. We will definitely be keeping track of what's going on out there in Nevada. And hopefully we'll get some, you know, sales figures from Florida in the days and weeks ahead. It's also worth noting again that NSSF says the sales of firearms, transfers of firearms in August back up to more than 1 million a month. So that is another positive sign. I'm glad to see that as well. And hopefully that will start a new streak here. Yeah, we'll continue on in September.
Yeah, we tend to see the figures start to kind of ramp up as we hit the hunting seasons. Mm-hmm. Might want to get a new rifle, new shotgun. So we're hitting those hunting season months. And of course, you know, Black Friday sales, everyone loves them and the retailers love them. And so we've actually worked with our retailers over the past several years. So instead of just having a Black Friday sale, they've spread those sales out throughout the week. That way we're not flooding FBI NICs and the system crashes. And that way we can run those background checks. But yeah, we're encouraging everybody to, you know, think about what they need for the fall. Think about what they need for the future and get out there and invest. I mean, the industry is still making incredible products. And we know that there are some, you know, questions about the economy. People have some concerns, but man, there's exciting things happening within these manufacturers who are bringing great products to the market.
Absolutely. All right, Mark, thank you so much for your time, man. We'll talk again very soon.
Great to see you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
You too. My thanks to Mark for joining us on the program. And hopefully tomorrow we're going to be talking more about that Third Circuit decision. I'd like to get one of the attorneys who's involved in the case to join us on the program. So I'll be making some phone calls and emails later today. And hopefully we'll be able to dive deeper into that 230 some odd page decision on tomorrow's Cam and Company. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of the Lone Star State of Texas. 67-year-old high-risk registered sex offender with 11 felony convictions, now free on bond after two recent arrests. This from Fox 26 in Houston, Texas. Now, listen, an arrest doesn't mean that you're guilty, right? And I don't believe in holding everybody who's arrested behind bars until they go to trial. But in this case, again, you've got somebody who's already been deemed to be a high-risk sex offender. 11 prior felony convictions, two arrests within a very short period of time. All of which, to me, adds up to this individual does pose a danger to the community, and the community would be better off if he were held without bond until his trial takes place. Lionel Coleman is the individual in question. Fox 26 says, since 1995, Coleman has been on the state's registered sex offender website following his conviction for indecency with a child. In recent weeks, he has been arrested twice and charged with felony indecent exposure. But 351st Criminal Court Judge Nate Cornelio granted Coleman bonds totaling $45,000. That's it. And generally, again, you pay 10% and you're out, right? Andy Kahan with Crime Stoppers in Houston says, hell no, this is not in the best interest of public safety. Defense attorney Brent Mays says, under the circumstances, legally, he is entitled to a bond, which, again, okay, that may be the case. Entitled but not required, right? It's an option for the judge, but the judge could have deemed Coleman, again, a threat to the community, and said, we believe it's in the best interest of justice and community safety that you are held without bond. According to court documents, Coleman was caught masturbating in a grocery store parking lot, as well as a Target parking lot, and inside a restaurant. One of his bond conditions states, quote, defendant is not to perform any indecent acts while in a public setting. Defense attorney Brent Mayer said, by putting this condition in place, if he does anything indecent, the judge can find that he violated his bond conditions by just a preponderance of the evidence, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and she could revoke his bond that way. Okay, so we got to have another, we have to have a fourth time whacking it in public before he can be held without bond. Again, I don't get it. Andy Kahn with the Crime Stoppers Houston says he's a menace to society. He's a menace to the public. You can't keep letting someone out to reoffend time and time again. I agree with that. And, you know, again, particularly when you've got this string of incidents in such a short period of time. Is this a violent offense? Is he accused of sexually assaulting somebody? No. But do we really need to see strangers doing that in public? No. And if he can't stop himself from doing that in public, then maybe he needs to be in a position where he can't do that in public. All right. On to today's armed citizen story. From Georgia. This from WMAZ in the state of Georgia. Eastman, Georgia is the dateline for this particular story. Eastman neighborhood shaken after deadly shooting. Here's what witnesses had to say. A neighborhood dispute on First Avenue left one man dead after he allegedly threatened a family and fired a gun in the air. That individual will be the one who is deceased now. Police are still investigating, but it certainly sounds like this was a case of self-defense. I would be utterly gobsmacked if police ended up presenting charges against the individual who shot and killed his attacker, because it sounds like he was attacked before he fired in self-defense. Terrence Travis Gordon was shot and killed on Sunday after what witnesses describe as an escalating series of threats that began hours earlier and culminated in gunfire in a residential porch. Tawana McRae said she and her husband were sitting outside their home when Gordon approached, allegedly making death threats after kind of lurking behind their house for a while. McRae said he loved us, but he was going to kill everyone in the house. Earlier in the day, Gordon had reportedly been going door to door, yelling at neighbors, firing shots in the air while attempting to open doors along the street. McRae said she and her husband tried to calm Gordon down. He appeared on their front porch, but she says Gordon fired first, which prompted her husband to shoot back, which, again, would be a clear-cut act of self-defense. WMAZ reports the shooting happened about 8 hours after Dodge County Sheriff's deputies responded to a separate domestic dispute involving Gordon on Saturday. Patrol Lieutenant Garrett Cooley says Gordon was screaming and upset about drugs and prostitution. Cooley said, I suspect there were some possible mental illness issues due to his agitated nature. But they say deputies were able to de-escalate the situation, calm Gordon down. Cooley said Gordon didn't commit any crime during the incident on Saturday. He said if there was a sign of family violence, anything of that nature, he said, of course, we would follow the law, take what actions are necessary, but just being upset and shouting, it happens every day. And he says these were not related incidents. He says when I left him, he was calm, compliant. He was no longer agitated. He was speaking in a normal term, or a normal tone, rather. McRae disagrees. She says that the deputy should have arrested Gordon during the encounter on Saturday. Her husband, thankfully, has been released from the hospital and is recovering. McRae says that her family has been shaken by the incident. They've actually received threats since the shooting took place. you know, again, if no crime was committed, you can't take somebody into custody. I would say, though, that if the police believe that there were some mental health issues going on, and they believe that Gordon might have posed a danger to himself or others, they could have taken him in for a mental health hold and mental health evaluation. But it sounds like, again, once they were able to de-escalate the situation, maybe they believe that Gordon didn't pose a danger to himself or others. If that was the case, then clearly they were mistaken. So we'll follow this case and provide some updates for you when they become available. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A man who was able to save a woman from rising floodwaters in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Just a couple of, well, I guess a couple of weeks ago now, it was back on August 12th, record flooding in the city of Chattanooga during that time period. A little more than 6 inches of rain in a matter of hours. Second most rainfall the city has seen since 1879. A lot of flooded streets, including a section of Interstate 24, which left people stranded, cars partially submerged. A woman named Bela Vasquez says she was stuck in her SUV. The water's rising all around her. She says we're nearly up to her chin inside the vehicle when a man named Troy Plemons came to her rescue. She said that, you know, when your time hasn't come, God will always send someone to rescue you and save you. I'm grateful to this young man because he risked his life. He arrived like a hero, and I'm grateful to God for that. Plemons says he thought nothing about jumping into the rising floodwaters to save a stranger in need, and the pair again recently reunited for the first time since he saved her life about a month ago. So in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Troy Plemons of Chattanooga, Tennessee, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Again, I want to thank you for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We will most likely be talking more about this Third Circuit decision, although we've also got, you know, the Seventh Circuit oral arguments coming up in the Illinois ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. So there's actually a lot of court stuff that we can talk about, and we most likely will be talking about one or both of those cases on tomorrow's program. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including what's come out of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. If you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Just use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. I'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.